You're listening to Sci-Fi for Me Radio. To do anything else would be highly illogical.
Hi everyone, Annalie Josephs here for SciFiForMe.com. We have with us from, you may know him from Once Upon a Time, you may know him from Mass Effect, Raphael Sparsh. How are you doing today?
Good. I'm good. Hi.
Now, I know we're taking a break from your once shooting schedule. How are things going? How hectic has that been?
It's been good. It's been a little hectic. We shoot in Vancouver, so I've been flying back and forth to do some scenes and then come back to LA. But it's going well. We premiere on Sunday, which everyone was very excited about, season three. And this is not a spoiler, but this is sort of public knowledge, obviously, that they left for Neverland at the end of season two. So as we come back, you'll be seeing a lot of Neverland for a while. But I do come back later in the season.
Well, and how has Neverland kind of changed the dynamic on set? Has a lot been changed? Has it been really the same feel, just kind of a different, different day, different story?
You know, at this point, there's not a lot of interaction with those of us in Storybrooke and Neverland, at least not from my point of view. But in terms of kind of the vibe on the show, the vibe is still great and everyone's excited. And the hallmark of the show has been the wonderful stories that they tell. I mean, they just, they really are so clever and the production values are so strong and the actors are just so good. So because of all of that, I'm saying this because I'm a fan of the show as well as also being in it. I love the work that I get to see on the show. And it feels the same. It's just that they're off in another world at the moment.
And you're definitely no stranger to different worlds. I know most of my friends heard your name and went, "Oh my God, the guy from Mass Effect," immediately recognized you as a voice actor. Mind you, I have very voice actor fanboyish friends. How does that dynamic change? Obviously, going from a TV here and there, a couple of recurring roles. I know you're on Star Trek. I know I first saw you in Darman and Greg, but I used to watch that with my mother a long time ago. How does that dynamic change acting to voice acting?
Voice acting is its own very own particular challenge, right? You are essentially alone in a room with a microphone, and you are invariably not interacting with any other actors. You are finding your way in the dark, as it were, with nothing to interact with. I mean, it's not dark in the recording room. It's just that there's nothing. You're literally, it's you and your imagination, right?
Absolutely. And,
when you're on, for example, a show like Once Upon a Time, which has a lot of money and huge budgets and opportunities to do sets and costumes and everything, there's not a lot that you need to actually imagine because it's all there, which is pretty exciting. The obviously the follow-up question is, what do you like better? And in point of fact, actually, I like both. They're just different. I came out of doing a lot of stage, a lot of Broadway, and a lot of theater, and the theater training was the best training for me with my my voice acting, because you have to be able to create a level of both intimacy and emotion through just your voice. You can't use your face and you can't use your hands and your eyes, and there's no look to cut to that can kind of give you sum up the scene. You have to basically sort of do it all through your voice. So again, doing that stage training was always the best way to do that. And I love doing voice acting. It's particularly incredible when you get to work with something like someplace like BioWare, who are, for all intents and purposes, kind of the AAA standard in the field. And then to have a game like Mass Effect, which the hallmark of kind of what they did was really create a game that was about relationships, right? It wasn't just about shooting, zombies. Which, you know, I've nothing against shooting zombies. You know, it's a good time can be had shooting zombies, and sometimes it's the perfect way to decompress. But at the end of the day, what Mass Effect did, which was different, is that they actually created team members, and those team members then had relationships with and or even relations with, and there was an opportunity to sort of explore in about 1,000 different directions, you know, kind of like the way life is sometimes, where you make a left here as opposed to a right, and then suddenly, in having made a left, that you have this whole other world than if you made that other choice. That interactive element, and then with your team members, kind of created a really rich world for Mass Effect, and that has created kind of a diehard, passionate, really intense fan base from the Mass Effect audience.
And they're wonderful games to begin with, and I know they brought in a lot of talented people. Other than that, fans of the genre will also know you from your work in the Star Wars games, which goes back, it's been about 10 years now, approximately.
Yes.
I'm trying to about do my math.
More, yeah. Star Wars Commando, and then some of the other Star Wars games. And one of the first games I did was called Grim Fandango, which was one of the early games. And then Knights of the Old Republic, and then EverQuest, otherwise known as EverCrack. For those who couldn't stop playing it. I've been really fortunate. Some of the opportunities I've had in the voiceover world, it's been really exciting.
Then that does kind of pose the question of how does it differ from one company to another? Is there a huge shift, or is it kind of more, again, same day, different world?
You mean game to game? How is it?
Yeah. Different games, different companies, different storylines, different characters. Obviously, different characters is a thing that's been delved into with acting theory over the years, but...
Yeah, I mean, there was a game that I was once cast in. It was a game... I won't mention any names, it was a game where I was essentially riding the back of a dinosaur, and they had said, yeah, you know, just prepare to come to yell a bit. Just, you know, it's a good game, and, you know, we'll come in and do it. Well, what happens is this. If you have a game where you're constantly screaming, you don't just sort of get a tired voice. You literally can't speak for 3 days, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, your voice literally goes to hamburger. If you're screaming it, you know, louder, you know, scream more, you know, make it more intense, and then you have to do 5 takes of that. By the end of it, you literally are out of commission for at least 3 days because you're hoarse. And I was this game because we were riding on the back of dinosaurs or dragons, I guess. Every single line was screamed over the sound of the flapping dragons. And then in addition to that, then you'd have the things where you'd have to scream even louder because you were doing this or that or whatever. And I at a certain point, I actually I quit. I quit the game because I couldn't do it and still be able to do my other work. So there are some games that require people to do, you know, actors to do a lot with their voices that is not in the best interest of their vocal cords. That is generally not the case with BioWare.
Just to kind of go ahead and bring it back around, if you don't mind talking again about Once, obviously you, in the first season, you've had the dog to work with, you've had a couple of different elements. How would you say that it has challenged you as an actor? Has there been anything that's been perhaps a unique situation in which maybe you're working with animals and you're not used to doing that? I mean, obviously on stage, that would be, that's the one thing they say you don't do.
Right. I've worked with animals before, you know, and they're fun. Each animal obviously has its own personality. The dog that we work with, his actual name is Cinder, as in Cinderella, but his stage name is Pongo. He's great. He's a very strong dog. He is actually the agility champion of Canada.
Oh wow!
what they do with agility dogs is they actually make them run an obstacle course, but then to train them, they put weights on them. And then on the day of the actual competition, they take the weights off. And so when they go, they're like a rocket. Anyway, this dog is incredibly strong. So he's knocked me over a fair amount of times, which is funny. But in terms of kind of, you know, what they've done in terms of the show, the challenges, I mean, look, if someone said to you, hey, I've got an idea for a TV show, it's a Disney show, we're going to take Snow White and, you know, Prince Charming and Jiminy Cricket, and we're going to give them, you know, these real life characters, and we're going to turn them into a story. Well, you know, I just get cavities even just thinking about that. You know, it's just like, are you kidding me? It just sounds like it could be horrible. Mm-hmm. And in lesser hands, I think it would have been horrible. The fact is that Adam Horowitz and Eddie Kitsis are really, really skilled storytellers. And what they've been able to do is tell stories that have great depth and dimension, surprising dimension to them. And as a result of that, they have been able to kind of really, in a way, I want to say, so support the actor as well as also protect the actor. Because, I mean, you know, you get cast as Jiminy Cricket, which is a fan favorite, and you think, great, oh, no, I hope I don't mess it up, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you,
like, it could really be like stepping in a big pile of poo, I guess, if they, you know, took it down the wrong way, right? But they told a story about him, a backstory about him that was so complex and really sad in a way and multidimensional, such that people then walk up to me and said, oh, wow, I didn't realize that was Jiminy Cricket's backstory. Whereas in point of fact, actually, in the original, you know, Pinocchio novel written by Collodal, you know, centuries ago, you know, Pinocchio actually squishes he squishes Jiminy Cricket because he doesn't want a conscience. So it was only in the movie that Jiminy Cricket actually became a bigger character. But what they've done is they've, through just the sheer force of the storytelling, really given us all something really exciting to do.
Oh, absolutely. And wonderful episodes.
That's what's been so fun about it. Yeah. And obviously it's found its audience in a big way. And it's also found its audience internationally, which doesn't always translate. I mean, sometimes people do entertainment that works in the United States, but it doesn't actually work outside of our borders because they're just somehow they're American stories or something, or comedy doesn't, for example, doesn't always travel. By going back to these old story tales and myths and wonderful things that they've used, they seem to have found a language that sort of transcends borders, you know, and in so doing, I get tweets from Finland and Hungary and Russia and France and Ireland and England and Australia. I mean, it's incredible on Twitter where, you know, Latin America, I mean, I'm leaving out countries, they'll be upset with me, but I mean, literally, I've heard from people from all over the world who said, oh my God, I love this show. It really touches my heart. I think about it all the time. These characters mean so much to me, and I have this real emotional connection with these stories. That's really remarkable. And from the point of view of being a part of that, that's I've been very grateful for that and you know, really thrilled to just be, you know, a member of the cast.
Is there a point where you were just like, wow, I've accomplished what I wanted to in life, I feel good? Or do you feel like you haven't hit a point where you're like, yeah, I've made it? Obviously, we're not talking peaks here because... You know,
yeah, I mean, look, I've been an actor since I was four. I started on Sesame Street. I've done 5 shows on Broadway. I've done over 30 movies. I've done hundreds of television things. I've starred in series before.
You've got an IMDb page everyone would drool over as an actor. Yeah.
I mean, I've done a lot of different things. You know, there are great hills and great valleys in any actor's career. And invariably, there's time when you're just not working. And you have to find, you know, somehow strength to keep going on and keep believing in yourself. I certainly feel like Once Upon a Time has been an enormous sort of hallmark of a benchmark of new success for me. and current success for me. But then so is Mass Effect. And I just heard that a series that I pilot that I did just got picked up for TNT, a Stephen Boschko show called Murder in the First, with Taye Diggs and Kathleen Robertson and an amazing cast, just an amazing cast. So I get to go do that as well. I've always sort of worked, and I get stopped a lot when people say, "Did I go to school with you?" or "You look familiar." They don't necessarily know where they know me from, which I'm perfectly fine with. You know, is this sort of, do I feel like I'm finally reached the top of Everest and I can put a flag there? No, because a career is sort of something where you just keep sort of seeing what comes next and what other opportunities you get to do and what other people you get to work with. I've learned to be very grateful and very humble for the success that comes along, because I've done it long enough to know how rare it is when it does come along. And there's so many people who are so gifted and so talented, and they don't get the opportunities. Ultimately, there's more people than there are chairs at the table for people to sit down at, you know?
Exactly.
You know, and so I, for one, am, there's never a day where I don't think, oh, I'm the luckiest guy in the world just for what these opportunities that have come my way. And you know, my hope and what I really strive for is a way to kind of create a career that continues to change. I mean, now I've done this for, you know, 45 years as an actor. You know, I'm hoping to keep having new things come my way. So that's really where I'm focused on. And that's what I get most excited about is, you know, just a chance to go work with other wonderful, wonderful artists. And certainly Once Upon a Time is that. Certainly Mass Effect has been that. And now Murder in the First is something that I'm really looking forward to.
Is Murder in the First going to, by chance, mean a reduced role in Once?
You know, what I'm being told is that there may be opportunity for us to do both. Murder in the First, the way TNT works is they order 10 shows as opposed to a full season of 22. And there may be an opportunity to do both, and that's certainly my hope. Thankfully, they're different audiences, so people are okay with those kinds of things. That's my hope. There's an enormous amount of people on Twitter that write me all the time and say how much Jiminy Cricket means to them and how much they love the part and how much they want more of him. So my hope is that can continue to happen. And it sounds like that may happen.
That's good news, definitely, for Once fans. I would be remiss not to mention what we spent some time, I know we talked at Dragon Con about Green Wish, and I know that's a joint effort between you and Ed Begley Jr. and let's see, who else was on the board on that one? I'm all names are slipping my mind right now. I know you guys started out of LA, correct?
Well, you're in Kansas.
Where, Kansas City, Kansas, Missouri.
So let me just talk about this actually in Kansas City. Green Wish is basically something that I founded. It's a nonprofit, and the idea of the nonprofit is that it's a nonprofit that supports other nonprofits that are local and that are green. The idea is that every community has potentially lots of both needs, that is environmental needs, and then smaller nonprofits that are doing work in the community that really make a difference in the community. So what we've done is we've been able to figure out a way to be able to kind of create chapters around the country and now internationally, it looks like, with setting up Green Wish chapters in those cities so that then green organizations there get identified, and the money that gets raised, 90 cents on the dollar, all goes directly back into the community. Well, I'm proud to be able to say we're about to open a chapter in Kansas City. I think within the next 3 months, you'll be hearing about it. I think there's Union Station there, I guess.
Yes.
There's some talk about having a launch party at Union Station. And if I'm there, I'm happy to do another interview with you at the time. We have a chapter in Lawrence, Kansas. We're opening one in Denver. We're in discussions to do one in Savannah, Georgia. We have one in LA. We're in discussions, open one in Vancouver, and then there are other cities that we're also in discussion with. And so what we're doing is that we're actually looking for people that maybe share a passion about the environment, and maybe some of that, sometimes that aching desire or need to want to try and figure out what they can do to make a difference, because there's so much need out there, right? There, if you pick up the paper any given day, holy smokes, it's really easy to get to apathy because you think, well, it's so terrible, why do anything, right?
Exactly.
This is a way potentially whereby which one can actually make a difference and bring money directly to your community. So it's community helping community. People who are interested in finding out about Greenwich, Kansas can go to greenwish.com or they can find me on Twitter. It's my name, Raphael Sparge, which is verified. In this case, if you want to write us at greenwish@greenwish.com, that'll get to one of us, and that will be able to tell you about what's happening both in the Kansas City chapter, or if you have a town or a city that you feel might be respond to something like this, I'd love to talk to you about it. It's sort of an open source charitable giving concept, so that you can actually set up your own nonprofit using all of our infrastructure and make a difference right away.
Well, thank you so much for your time again. We really appreciated it. I know you have a busy schedule. Is there anything that we need to really be looking out for other than this big Greenwich possible release opening in Kansas City?
Yeah, the only other thing I'd love to tell you about is just briefly is a show that I produced with Ed Begley, which is called On Begley Street. And Ed is building a platinum LEED certified home, and we follow the journey of that. It just got released on Evokes Television, which is online, or on various other channels, Roku or Xbox or Samsung channels. But if you go to EVOX Television, evokestelevision.com, On Begley Street is there. I'm sure you could Google it as well. I directed it and produced it. But it's fun and it's engaging, and the Begleys are great television. So I'd love for people to find out about that as well.
All right. Well, thank you again so much. This has been Annalee Josephs for SciFiForMe.com, and we've been talking with Raphael Sparsh, and this has been a production of Sci-Fi for Me Radio. Check out our other podcasts on Sci-Fi for Me Radio. You can find that through our main site or on iTunes.
This has been a presentation of SciFiForMe.com. Copyright 2013 by Flaming Dog Media, LLC. All rights reserved. No portion of this program may be retransmitted without the express written consent of Flaming Dog Media. This is Sci-Fi for Me Radio. Be careful what you wish for.